Muy buenos días, muy buenas tardes, muy buenas noches. Este es Luis Alberto Jovel desde Australia y viniendo aquí con José Villalobos desde La Mirada a Estados Unidos. En este episodio de Notas Teológicas traemos al erudito conocido por todo el mundo, al doctor Craig Keener, y ahora lo voy a introducir. Welcome, Craig, to Notas Teológicas. We're very happy, José and I, to have you with us. We would like you to tell us many things and to talk to the Spanish-speaking people. And I know that you've been to Guatemala lately. And maybe you can tell us something about you, a bit of your background, both academic and your life, and also about your trips to Latin America that you've done. Maybe your experiences with food.
mucho gusto. It's great to be with you. Okay, this shirt is from Guatemala. I was just there. But yeah, I mix up my dates. I was just there like 2 weeks ago, I think, teaching a class at Sateca. Anyway, it's great to be with you. And my background, I was converted from atheism. I didn't grow up in church. Some people brought me the gospel on the street, and I argued with them for 45 minutes, but the Holy Spirit converted me later that day. And that was the beginning of my Christian life. But the little kids in Sunday school knew more about the Bible than I did, so I had to try to catch up. So I started reading 40 chapters of the Bible a day. If you do that, you can read through the New Testament every week or through the Bible every month. I mean, I try to focus in more detail now, but what that did, it gave me a perspective, helped me to read things in context once I started doing that. That was really important. My PhD is from Duke University in New Testament and Christian Origins. I have, I guess, 26 books. But the last time I counted, it was 26.
Some of
I
them are
need
double or quadruple.
Yeah, the Acts book is actually four volumes. It's 4,500 pages. But in terms of more readable things, the IVP Bible Background Commentary gives background in each passage of the New Testament. It is it's sold over 500,000 copies. It is in Spanish and published by Casa Batista, which there's also other names for the publisher, Baptist Spanish Publishing House, and so on. And also, there's a book that's been downloaded about, I think, 200,000 times in Spanish, and that's the Bible in Context. It was just a basic interpretation manual. Those are more basic, so they're not like my Acts commentary or something like that. It's more geared towards academic.
Yes, I remember reading going through the IBP one in maybe in 2000, and I really enjoy it. And I mainly remember when you mentioned this is what stuck the first time I went through it, the how the people who were fleeing from Jerusalem when they were in the year 70, how they even swallow some diamonds, and the Roman soldiers were opening them up. I was so amazed of reading that. I said, "Oh, what's going on?" So, and where do you teach now? I mean.
Yes, I teach at Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky, and it's a great place. We have a lot of international students. My wife is from Congo, Congo Brazzaville, and she actually was a refugee, not from Jerusalem, but from there was a civil war there. She was a refugee for 18 months. Her PhD is from University of Paris 7, and she's wonderful.
Yes, I seen that your son graduated this year, or
Yes, yeah. Yeah, he graduated with a worship arts degree from Asbury University, and our daughter is getting ready to start there.
Okay, it's quite interesting because Like I said, Jose is Lutheran, I'm Baptist, and you are.
Well, I'm ordained in a Baptist denomination, but I have some Pentecostal proclivities.
Like us, yes,
So,
just like Jose and
yeah.
me.
So yeah, I'm a mixture of different, a bunch of different things.
We,
Yes.
Craig, we like to make a distinction between classical Pentecostalism and neo-Pentecostalism, just so we can make a distinction that we're not, we don't believe in that the type of Pentecostalism that gets a little crazy, and the like. So we do make a distinction. I don't know if you do, but we like doing that, and I think that it caught on. No, Luis, I think that people nowadays do tend to make a distinction between, say, the classical Pentecostalism that went around the world and took the gospel and reached so many people, versus the kind of name it and claim it and those type of occurrence.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's where we make the cut. In a sense, in here in Australia, or at least in Melbourne, most of the Spanish-speaking churches are Pentecostals, and believe it or not, there are only 24 million Australians, but there are like 15 churches, Spanish-speaking churches here in Melbourne, Spanish. And the issue why we do these things, Craig, is because we want the Spanish-speaking community to be introduced to real scholarship. Usually, there are a lot of people who have don't have a degree or don't even have a theological background, but because either they claim to be Jewish or they know a little bit of Hebrew, they open up anything on Facebook and charge people $25, $50 a class, and they are not qualified. So, why we do this, and in your case, you have Spanish-speaking resources, so we want them to get to know who the real deal is, not people who claim to have any theological knowledge, and at the end they don't. So they grow up in a sense. And your book on interpretation is quite helpful. I even when you put it out, I put it on my blog right away. Oh, this is for free. Finally, a PDF for free, which is legitimate, and we're not stealing from the author. Well, thank you for.
That one actually, I wrote it specifically. Like, if anything I do through a publisher, the publisher owns the rights, and so I would be cheating the publisher. I can't really offer it without their permission. But that one, I just didn't go through a publisher. I just did it free online, and then a friend in Cuba translated it into Spanish, and now it's, yeah. Now it's online.
Yeah,
So.
and I think you say only 200 times, but it was downloaded. But I think it was 200,000 times it's been downloaded. You meant
Yeah.
200,000.
Oh,
Yes,
sorry. I
because
said
only 200 times, that's not possible. It's like
yeah.
your commentary on your IBP commentary. So talk about when I mentioned that I noticed. I don't know if you noticed, but when I mentioned that I was going to interview you, people saying that's all they were talking about, the IBP commentary. The IBP commentary is such a good thing. So, well, we're going to start with the questions, and I'd like you to start, Jose. I mean, I have we have some questions for you. This is
There's also,
not the Inquisition. That's what I'm hopefully.
there's also spirit hermeneutics has also been translated into Spanish.
Yes, by Kerygma. Yes. Yes. I ordered a book just the day before yesterday, but in English. Because the issue with me is that, like Jose, I got to the US when I was 10. So for us, reading in English is a lot quicker. Quicker. And we've done all our primary, secondary, university, and postgraduate in English. So we're versatile, but when people tell me, "Can you read this book?" I say, "Oh, is it in English?" Because I can read it faster in English. Although I can read Spanish, but I like to go to the ad fontes.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's get started. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is exploring a little bit of the subject of miracles. And I know that you were interview and you were interview on this subject. I can't remember where. I think it was I'm gonna say apologetics something. Podcast, but yeah, you're talking about Hume's objection to miracles, and the question that I have is, if you can tell us about Hume's central objection to miracles.
Sure. Yeah. Most of the people today who say, we know miracles don't happen. Well, why do you know that? Well, we just know. But ultimately, the objection became popularized through David Hume. He got some of it from earlier deists, although the earliest deists didn't go as far as he did. But there are two main parts to his argument. The first part is that miracles are violations of natural law, and we know that natural law can't be violated. Of course, saying that God can't act within nature, who believes in a God like that anyway? God isn't subject to natural law. So he does a trick with definitions to try to rule out miracles a priori. But there's a problem even with him speaking about miracles being violations of natural law. I mean, if I have a pen and I drop it, the law of gravity means it's gonna fall, right? But if I catch it, I haven't broken a law of nature. I've acted within nature. If I can do that, why can't God act
Exactly.
within nature? But another problem with his argument is that his definition of natural law is not even the definition of natural law that's used in modern science, which it's much more descriptive today. Plus, he's getting this from Newton and the Newtonians. Isaac Newton and his early followers believed in biblical miracles. So this was never a scientific objection. It was a philosophy of science objection from the start. But who says that miracles are violations of natural law? Well, I think he rests that on the second part of his argument. And the second part of his argument is very circular. The second part of his argument is uniform human experience shows us that miracles don't happen. Well, how uniform is that uniform human experience? He has to start making exceptions right away. He says, well, people who don't belong to white European civilizations don't count. So he's ethnocentric from the start, which fits what we elsewhere. I mean, he was pro-slavery. He said that only white civilizations had ever achieved anything. Very ethnocentric, bigoted, so on. But also, he made other kinds of exceptions. He says, no educated people believe this. Oh, then he gives an example of Blaise Pascal's niece. Of course, Blaise Pascal is like the father of the modern computer and so on. Brilliant mathematician. And fervent follower of Jesus. Well, his niece had a running eyesore that emitted a foul odor, and she was at a Jansenist monastery, and she was touched with a holy thorn from Jesus' crown of thorns. Now, I personally do not believe it was really a holy thorn from Jesus' crown of thorns. I mean, there were fake relics all over the place at that time, but it was a contact point for faith. She was instantly and publicly healed. The Queen Mother of France sent her own physician to check it out and confirmed it. So here's what Hume says. Hume says, ah, this is better documented than any miracle in the Bible, any of these ancient miracles. And yet we know this didn't happen, so why would we believe anything else? And that's his argument. I mean, it's entirely circular. He says uniform human experiences against miracles. You say, how do you know it's uniform? Well, because no credible witness claims that there are miracles, that they've seen miracles. And you say, well, what about this witness? Ah, they're not credible.
It sounds like the people who I hear, and actually they're Lutherans, Jose. there's a guy who I listen to issues, etc. Fighting for the faith. And this guy, he's always saying, if there's miracles, where's the proof? And you tackle that objections. Where's the proof? Where are the cameras? Where are the pictures? And it becomes a circular objection.
Yeah, because I mean, you can pick apart any individual case and say, well, I just don't believe that. I've had people tell me that if somebody were raised from the dead in front of them, I mean, I ask them that, they say, no, I wouldn't believe that. So it's like, well, what is going to convince you then? I mean, it's everybody has a different level of what the burden of proof should be. But if it's you make it insurmountable, well, nobody's going to be able to persuade you. But that's not the fault of the proof. That's the fault of, you know, the presuppositions. There was a Pew survey done in 2006 of Pentecostals and Charismatics in 10 countries. And according to that survey, somewhere around 200 million people claimed to have witnessed or experienced divine healing. The survey also talked about 39% of other Christians, those who didn't claim to be Pentecostal or Charismatic, who claimed to have witnessed or experienced divine healing. So we're talking about hundreds of millions of people who claim to experience this, Christians. Also, we know that there are millions of people who became Christians from non-Christian backgrounds because they believed that what they witnessed was so extraordinary, it was not the norm. They were willing to abandon centuries of other tradition to become Christians when they experienced these things. So you can't just a priori start by saying uniform human experience excludes this, because you're just excluding all that testimony. Nobody's going to say all that testimony is accurate. Nobody's going to say all of that can only be explained as a miracle. But neither can you start from the premise that uniform human experience excludes the possibility of miracles.
Well, you have to ask the question. I mean, how do you know that? I mean, have you been to all four corners of the earth? Yeah. Or not only that, but have you been to all four corners of the universe? You know, to know this. I mean, that's a wild claim. I in my estimation.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, in New Testament scholarship, Rudolf Bultmann was known for that. He said, you know, these things are legends in the New Testament. And to be consistent, when somebody brought up a German Lutheran, here's a Lutheran for Jose, a German Lutheran pastor by the name of Johann Christoph Blumhardt, where there were healings, apparently even raisings from the dead, experiences like this, like what you have in the Gospels. Bultmann said, oh, those are just legends too. This was from like a generation or two before him. But today we actually have journals, diaries, letters. We have firsthand accounts from Johann Christoph Blumhardt and those who knew him that attest these things. The scholar who introduced the idea that, you know, these New Testament miracles are myths, David Friedrich Strauss, in the 1800s, Strauss said, well, you know, these accounts in the Gospels, they were myths that arose over the course of many, many generations. So he dated the Gospels later than almost anybody today would date them. But he should have known better, because he actually had a friend by the name of Edward Morica, who was unable to walk very easily, at least, due to a diagnosed spinal problem. And Morica spent some time visiting Blumhardt, and after a while, Strauss gets a letter from him, and Morica is hiking in the mountains. He's feeling much better now, and Strauss dismisses it and says, that's just psychosomatic. He just was psychosomatically ill, despite the fact that it had been diagnosed by doctors. But what Strauss didn't say was, this is merely a myth or a legend that arose over the course of generations, because he couldn't say that. So he couldn't be consistent with what existed in his own day.
So, that's so, right. So even like Jesus said, in the parable that even if someone from the dead would raise up and tell him, they wouldn't believe it.
That's great.
So those are the objections, Jose did, because this is your second question. Because Jose was the one who made up this question.
Yeah, he Luis gave me homework, therefore I got to work, and I came up with this question. Let me know if there if they if any of them are outrageous. We'll just stop right in then. I'm just kidding.
But your second question, I think it goes well with what Craig has said regarding the circular, because your second question has to do with, let me see, what are the problems with Hume's arguments and how could we answer them? So one of them, I think you have answered them, that is a circular, it becomes a circular argument.
And again, claiming uniform human experience, I mean, you have,
Ethnocentric.
yeah, complete, it's ethnocentric. He actually said in one of his other works, he said, oh, you know, no, nobody other than white civilizations has produced anything great. And he said, oh yeah, there's one Jamaican who can recite poetry, but yeah, any parrot can repeat what it hears. I mean, so big. And the Jamaican to whom he referred was Francis Williams, who composed his own poetry in English and in Latin. So, you know, it very, very bigoted. And he had other pieces of his objections too. He said, well, all religions claim miracles at their founding. What do you expect? They do that just to prove that they're right. Not all religions do claim that. There's some religions that claim it more than others. But even so, I mean, that doesn't mean that if one is false, then they're all false. And it also doesn't mean that they're all false. I mean, Christians don't say that you don't have superhuman, extra human phenomena in other religions. First of all, we don't believe that God only hears Christians' prayers. God has compassion. His rain falls on the just and the unjust. And secondly, we also believe the Bible talks about other spirits. You've got pharaohs, magicians, you've got all sorts of other things. So Hume's objections really don't work against the God of the Bible. And the idea of miracles being a violation of nature doesn't fit most biblical miracles. Virgin birth, resurrection, creation, I mean, those are out of this world, right? But most miracles in the Bible, I mean, the parting of the sea in Exodus 14, it says God sent a strong east wind and blew it back all night. Obviously, you're not going to have it without divine intervention right at the time that the Israelites need to cross. But at the same time, how can you call that a violation of nature when he sends a strong east wind? He works with his creation very often. Hume's objections, just from the time he made them, they fell apart. He wouldn't accept the testimony of multiple independent eyewitnesses like you have for Jesus' resurrection. And somebody actually came up with a probabilistic argument, calculated mathematically. I think it was Charles Babbage, that came up with this and Bayes' theorem. And they just completely refuted probabilistically his argument about, you know, you never can trust the witnesses because this is against uniform human experience. Well, if you've got enough multiple independently attested eyewitnesses, then you have to pay attention. And you can't say, well, nothing like this happens, it's against uniform human experience, unless you a priori rule out that there have been other miracles. It's entirely circular.
In the issue with Christianity, and we're going to talk about this later, but the issue with Christianity is that many people are willing to accept the miracles within the Bible, but they don't accept anything else apart from it. So it's an issue, and not to name names, but maybe I can name the programs or the where they said, like you said, there were many other spirits. And this week I heard both from the White Horse Inn and also from this Issues, etc., Lutheran one, regarding Psalm 82 and Psalm 86, Psalm 82, where it says God is seated in the council of the gods. And they said, no, they're just talking about human judges. But the worldview has been so much westernized that that's the first thing that came into my was that, oh, they must be judges. While the Jewish, and we're talking about people who have, who are well versed, who are experts in their field, but yet they don't want to. I think there's a rejection in accepting that the ancient Israelites or the Jews at the time of Jesus, they believed that they were spirits, that there was a divine thing, and they said, no, it's only talking about human beings, and it becomes an issue because then I could understand. Oh, that's why you're a secessionist, because you don't even believe that there's a spiritual warfare going on.
Yeah, I mean the New Testament, it's pretty obvious. You've got demons. Jesus is casting them out. Jesus certainly believed in them. There were a number of cessationists, meaning miracles have ceased. But by the way, I should qualify, there are different kinds of cessationists. So some will say the gifts have ceased, but God is still God. God can do miracles when he wants to, and so they don't deny miracles. Those are, you might call them soft cessationists, and we get along really well.
Yes.
But then there are the hard cessationists. Well, these were hard cessationist missionaries from the U.S. to Korea in the early 20th century, and they had been taught that demons were just psychological problems. By the way, I do believe you can have psychological problems without demons. I'm not equating them, but there's also such a thing as demons. So they didn't believe in those, and they didn't believe God did miracles anymore. Well, then the Korean revival broke out in the first decades of the 20th century, and millions of people were being converted, and people were being healed. Demons were being cast out from people who had been involved with spiritism and so on. And the missionaries were very disturbed, and so they commissioned a study and discovered, yes, these things really are happening. And so many of the missionaries were converted to believing in the reality of miracles and the reality of demons, which are much less pleasant than miracles. But anyway.
Yes. It's the same thing happened with the Missouri Synod, Jose, with their mission in Madagascar.
I heard. I heard that there's a pastor there who's casting demons left and right, and it's awesome. So not all Lutherans are close-minded. There are some smart ones out there. Me being one of them.
And there was they published a book.
Blow my mind. Anyway.
There's a book, Not Afraid, by Bennett, published by, I think, Concordia, maybe.
Yeah, that's the one we're referring to, that pastor. I was going to ask you because we speaking of miracles is kind of off. This isn't part of the questions I had, but you just reminded me of. Of Kublai Khan's invasion of Japan, and there is I guess there's a typhoon that wipes them out, that wipes out the fleet, and then they try it a second time, and there's a second typhoon that wipes them out, and the Japanese, they thank their gods because is their god is protecting them from the invasion from Genghis Khan's is I think it's a grandson, if I'm not mistaken, and those are amazing stories that they believe in miracles like that, and the way that I see it is that, to me the way I interpret it is that, well, it's God's mercy on his creation, and that's the way I interpret that.
Yeah.
Anyhow, this.